Hello, you're listening to Living Alone Together. I am your only host, Yen. So today, I've been quite unsuccessful with the recording. I've been recording for 2 hours and 20 minutes now, and nothing good has come out of this. I've just been re-recording again and again. Some of the recordings were more than 5-10 minutes long, so it added up to 2 hours and more. I just really wanted to chat today because, as you know, the previous one was 5 days ago only, so that's not many days to gather anything substantial on my mind. Not that there's normally anything substantial on my mind anyway, but there are a few things I can talk about, and I did finish a book yesterday, so I might talk about that one, except it's not the kind of book that is easy to discuss, so I'll see what I can say about it later on. I guess the first thing I could say is that the weather has been great the past 2 weeks or so, as in you could see the sun the first thing in the morning, which is not the case in February or prior to February. Before March, it was really just gloomy, gray, a little bit chilly, windy, and it was just overall not very pleasant, and you wouldn't want to go outside. And if you did go outside, you wouldn't be sitting in a park or in a garden. You would just be strolling around with your ugly dog and your ugly jacket. And I'm just joking. But point is, finally, we can see a bit of sun in the morning. And I've been forcing myself to get out the first thing in the morning, as in within 30 minutes of waking up. And you have to understand, I don't live in a fancy-ass house with a garden or a courtyard or a balcony even. There's just a fire escape. And before I get outside, I would have to pass 10, 15 flats, a big long corridor, several flights of stairs. So it's not entirely an easy or happy process. So I've been changing my routine, just trying to get out first thing in the morning, and then on my way back, maybe I can get some coffee or something nice. And then start the day that way. So there's that. The weather has been good. And another thing that has changed or has happened in the past week or so was I went to the dentist after 2 years of not seeing any dentist. And it turned out that there's this big gaping hole in my tooth. So I have to get a filling, and the bill came out altogether to be 325 quid, 35 for the consultation, the x-rays, 65 for, hygienist visit, whatever that means. I think it just means like cleaning my mouth, my teeth, and my gum, everything. And then the rest, 200 and more, for, the composite filling. So it's going to be white filling, not the mercury one. And so I don't know what to make of this price. Basically, considering the 2 years of negligence, which was priceless, I would say it's okay. Plus, the fillings should last about 10 years or more. So if you take that into consideration, it's probably okay. It's just that the upfront fee of 300 quid is just a lot. So the thing is that in the UK, they do have the NHS, everyone has it, and if you're living here. And the thing is, theoretically, right, if you're an NHS dentist patient, then you would pay one of the three fees. Band A is 26, band B, I think it's 66 or so. And then band C is 300. So if you're doing a consultation, an x-ray, and some simple treatment, you would just have to pay £26. But the thing is, apparently it's been a crisis of sorts. So it's extremely difficult to get onto the list. So you can't really register as an NHS patient for the dentist. And even if you have been an NHS patient for some time, there's a risk of being kicked out after several years of inactivity. And I think the reason for that is pretty simple. Just people don't get paid as much if they take on NHS patients. So maybe they only get like £30 or something for filling 6 teeth in an hour, maybe. Who knows? So that's all very understandable. And so I think most people just are private patients when it comes to their teeth. And that's the point when I figure out there's something called medical tourism, which I sort of vaguely know that it exists, but I never really imagine anyone going through this. For example, people would go to Hungary or Budapest because it's just 2 hours away from the UK, and they would stay for 3-4 nights maybe, and then the treatment would be half the price of the UK. So all in all considered, they also get some tourist activities done. It's just a better experience doing it in Hungary or Budapest, sorry, Hungary or Romania, for the same kind of treatment, etc., etc. So I looked up what my case would require. So I need one filling, and to do that in Budapest, I think it's about 100 euros. And then considering the flight and hotels for 1 week or 5 days, let's say, it's probably going to be the same price. But that means that if I'm actually going for something more expensive, I could actually save a little bit because of the price difference. So I understand the whole thing. I just want to say that I feel like I get this icky feeling thinking about medical tourism, because yes, it's all very reasonable, it's all very legal, and you get the best out of what you're paying, and you're free to do that, and you want to do it, you should do it. But for me, as a bystander, or as someone who is just aware of this alternative, I just feel like there is this ultra efficiency that comes with this whole thing that makes me feel a bit icky. And of course, how I feel doesn't really change anything, but it's my channel, so I can talk about how I feel. But yeah, I just feel it's just too ultra efficient to do all of that research and to do this thing. And it just feels like at once you feel, maybe I can do it next time. But at the same time, you feel like, why does everything have to be so optimized, right? And you get the idea that if you apply this kind of thinking to everything you do, first of all, you're going to be exhausted, but also you're just going to always feel unsatisfied because you feel like there's always a better option technically out there, and you can never do the best. And because by definition, there's probably always something better out there, I think. When it comes to efficiency and price and everything else, right? Of course, people could argue that maybe the care there isn't as good, or if anything happens, it's going to be a big hassle. And apparently, if you come back to the UK, doctors here are reluctant to work on whatever was done to you in Hungary, for example. So obviously, it might not be the technically best option. But let's say if everything goes smoothly, it just feels too efficient, just feels too utilitarian, and I personally don't like that kind of feeling. So I wouldn't do it. But of course, I'm just talking about the feeling. Suppose I got a bill that's like £5,000 for whatever it is, knock knock, maybe I'll consider doing it. So I'm a good hypocrite, you could say. Wow, the sun is really, really shining into my room, so it's great. All right, so there's one thing, the dentist. As for an extension of that, I guess it's my general attitude on visiting the doctors. So I was brought up in Taiwan, where the healthcare system is pretty, pretty cheap, and doctors are very efficient. And I think there's something I really don't like about this culture, which is that people just rely on the doctors all the time. You see more clinics than restaurants. A lot of people actually visit the clinic every single week, every two or three times. And it's not like it's separate. It's not like the clinic is the pharmacy. No, there are pharmacies as well. There are over-the-counter drugs that you can get. But people still like to visit the clinic and chat to the doctor. And it's just a very weird phenomenon for me. I've never really got it because there's always this smell in the clinic. So I just physically don't like being in clinic. But on top of that, like, what's the point? If you're fine, why do you have to visit a clinic? But the thing is, the case is just that it's so cheap. You know, you pay £5 and you go talk to a professional for 20 minutes. And some people maybe get a kick out of that, I imagine, especially if you are statistically old and you sort of feel better just by talking to a doctor or a human being, and or if you're lonely, you might meet your friends there. So it's like a culture, big cultural thing, and that's something I never really liked. But at the same time, it's just the healthcare in Taiwan, I don't know too much about it, but from my personal experience, I don't think, it is certainly very fast and efficient, but I don't necessarily think that the doctors are that good. And this is going to get a lot of backlash if you actually know people from Taiwan, or if you are from Taiwan, whatever. Point is, I feel like they're so efficient that they have like a very rigid mental model in their mind. Well, they have a very rigid mental model that they don't really see you as a whole person. So in other words, you're just a set of data to them, and they can process things very, very quickly and fairly accurately, but there are circumstances that would require some sort of nuance that they don't get to process in that short period of time, and often they just want to be fast. I get that feeling sometimes when I visit the doctors in Taiwan, and so I've decided that my verdict is that it's not necessarily better to have easily accessible healthcare. The price certainly is important, but it's just there are some drawbacks to that. That's all I'm saying. But at the same time, I have to say the peak of ultra efficiency comes when you are a dual citizen and you've got the US passport and the Taiwanese passport. And I know a lot of people who practically they live in the US 89% of their time, but when it comes to a serious disease, they would still prefer to fly back or fly to Taiwan to get their treatment. And again, this gives me this very icky feeling, like they're not wrong to do that, and they do pay for the insurance and they pay for their own tickets and everything. It makes me feel icky in this case, not just because of the ultra efficiency, but because they're treating citizenship as a mere tool, which you can argue that it is, but I can understand why for the people who are only Taiwanese and living in Taiwan, they could feel a little bit violated when this happens, when they know that people do this, because they're just, it's not going to conflict with their own medical examination. It's not like they're going to cut into queues or anything like that. But it just feels a bit icky, you know, like the whole system we've built up is for all the people on the island. But wow, they're just like so many people who have all the privileges of another country. But when it comes to healthcare, they pick and choose, and they sort of grocery shop and shop around, and they come to our country. It's like the island has become just another brand of grocery store, right? If you think about it that way, you might feel like a vegetable in that grocery store, and I don't know, it's a weird comparison, but sorry, it's a weird analogy, but I understand how people have strong feelings against that, because it does make everything look very, very instrumental, including a citizenship is very instrumental. And if you only got that citizenship, I think you're right to feel a little bit violated. And obviously the cost of things matter as well. The healthcare system that is proposed to be crumbling down, that kind of claims actually do foster that kind of icky feeling, I think. But anyway, it's none of my business. I'm not the kind of person to do that. I just do know that a lot of people do that. And a lot of students, obviously, who are not double citizens, sorry, who are not dual citizens, they do it as well. They're not going to get treatment in the US because it's too expensive. So just some observations and some rambling. The purpose of this one is really to chat, nothing too serious. Right. I guess it's time maybe to talk about the book a little bit, since I've got nothing else on my mind. Actually, there's something else, which is that I've been reading a little bit. Well, I've been spending a lot of time on Reddit, and I'm not okay. I'm a bit ashamed of that, but there's this post that you know, someone asks casually if the UK is more like the US or Europe, and my instinct was to say the US, but surprisingly for me, a lot of people say it's much more European than American. And I now recall that I made an episode and I talk about how the UK being Anglophone is an important part of their identity, blah blah blah, and I'm just a bit embarrassed by my remark because obviously I know very little about this country, and me being Canadian, I'm also not American as well, so I don't know exactly what they mean by American culture. So I don't know the truth. I don't know if it's really more European or American. I do know that they get a lot of holiday times if you're doing full-time work here, and the healthcare system is supposed to be more like the European systems. But first of all, European is a very big concept. It covers so many countries, so I don't know what they mean by that. But and also, I just don't understand how being Anglophone has nothing to do with the culture. I feel like the language really does matter, right? I don't know. This is probably going to be a debate. Maybe I'll have to do some research on this. So yeah, I think it's interesting that people are thinking of themselves as European rather than as more European than like the Americans, right? So that's something that I just casually observed the past couple of days. All right. So I suppose I could talk briefly about the book that I've been reading and that I finished yesterday, which is called Wanting, The Power of Mimetic Desire, and How to Want What You Need by Luc Borges. And I've got really mixed feelings about this book. It is divided into two parts. So the first part is illustrating what he means by mimetic desire, and the second part is more practical and tells us how to be anti-mimetic and how to basically be unique. And the first part is consists of a bunch of anecdotes and a lot of illustrations using his stories and some accounts from entrepreneurs and companies, public profiles, and there are a lot of illustrations in between where he talks about the cycle of generating an inauthentic and a mimetic desire. So he goes into the definition of it, and then basically, it's pretty straightforward. Mimetic desire just means that the desire is not sort of wrong. It's not original. It's something that you get by observing a model in your life, and you copy it. So a simple way to think about this is, maybe you have a role model in your life. Maybe it's your mother, maybe it's your friend, and you sort of see what they're doing in their lives and you desire what you think they desire, right? So in other words, and I think that's an interesting part, I think he talks about how it's not, you don't just want to become another person. You want to desire the same thing as what they desire. So in a way, you sort of extrapolate from their sight. So you follow what they're looking at. Instead of just looking at them, you look at what they're looking at. So you're one step ahead of the thing, which makes, and that's how you transform what you observe from another person into your own. So that is quite interesting. And he gives an example of babies that do this, right? Babies not just look at their mothers, they look at what their mothers are looking at. So that is sort of a very primal example of mimetic desire. And this whole idea sort of comes from the philosopher Girard, and is a French guy. And this guy, like throughout the book, he just quotes a lot of things, or he paraphrases a lot of ideas from a bunch of works of this other French philosopher. So and the whole premise of the book is that mimetic desires are not desirable, right? They lead to unwanted consequences. And like a big example he used was Tony Hsieh, which is I think an American entrepreneur who founded this Zappos, which is a shoe delivery online business. And he sort of talked about how his models failed because it was just the company culture was based on mimetic desire, something like that. Anyway, so I didn't really take a lot of notes. It's just it's a very straightforward concept, and once you look, and he just uses a lot of examples to elaborate this system of desires, mimetic machine, mimetic desire, models. And one thing, and this is not even interesting, he just brings up this distinction between celebrity versus freshman. So yes, we can aspire to be like a celebrity, but really that kind of aspiration isn't so as negative as aspiring to be to like the same things as our neighbors, right? And so he sort of explains why envy plays out in the latter case, but not in the former case, because they're so far away from us, so it doesn't really affect us, etc., etc. So it's not really like groundbreaking stuff, but it's sort of just the first part just lays the groundwork really for the second part. And I think the second part is more important, because he tries to give like a path forward, trying to explain how we could be more original, more authentic, more anti-mimetic. I do suspect almost like 80% through the book that this book is not really for individuals. This is for people who aspire to open their own company, to start a startup, because a lot of this is oriented on company cultures and what will happen if your company what will happen if your company motivates this mimetic cycle, where people are just envious and competitive in circles and not really moving anything forward. So I have a feeling that he had these people in mind when it comes to the audience, but it's not entirely useless even if you're just reading it for fun or for yourself. And there are some interesting observations for, I guess, especially for American audience. There are some labels that he created, for example, thin and thick desires. So just by the words of them, it just means thick desires are more substantial, they're going to be everlasting, they're going to really propel you in life, whereas thin desires just going to create false motion, as in you feel like you have progress, but in the end you're just like going up and down, going up and down, and you get this new thing and you're satiated for a very, very brief second, and it's gonna go down again, because they're not real substantial desires. They're not really things that your body, your mind, or your soul really craves for. And we should really just try to figure out what our thick desires are and how we can really feel satiated and fulfilled for a very long time. And that's the gist of the whole book, really. It's really about just recognizing that a lot of things that we think we want are not what we really want. And it's just a good practice to always to be aware of the models that are influencing our choices, and really just, you know, the general message is just try to dig deeper and try to find your thick desires and figure out what you really want. So it's really vague still. By the end of it, I don't have any, like, there's no practical advice that really, so to speak. It's just, but I think the book's value really is in its theoretical aspect. So there are a bunch of quotes that I wrote down. Maybe I could share these and then I can talk about how I feel about this book in greater detail. So there's this funny quote I read on page 136. He says, "When the focus is on how to set goals rather than how to choose them in the first place, goals can easily turn into instances of self-flagellation." I just think when he says self-flagellation, I had to write it down. So yeah, I don't remember the context of this quote, but it's pretty self-evident. It's not about the how, it's about the why, really. You have to know why you're going for something, or else you'll be self-flagellating. All right. And another quote on the goals, most people aren't fully, I really need to find out where the quote is from because I cannot discern my own handwriting. Give me one sec. All right, most people aren't fully responsible for choosing their own goals. People pursue the goals that are on offer to them in their system of desire. Goals are often chosen for us by models, and that means the goalposts are always moving. So I think a great example of this is the beauty standard, which it's pretty self-evident. The beauty standard changes every decade or every 2 years or so. There's always this new trend, and maybe one decade ago it was this to be curvy, and the other decade is to be like a signpost or something, and you're always never gonna be perfect because you're never gonna, it's gonna be moving so fast you can never catch up to the trend. So I feel like this is what it's talking about. It's pretty evident, but it's still good to read it on paper, black and white, in a published book. Goals are often chosen for us by models. Okay, so this is another quote. Okay, so the mimetic desire is the unwritten, unacknowledged system behind the visible goals. That's basically what it is. So that's why I have this mixed feeling about this book, because it's like, yeah, it's pretty self-evident once he writes it down, but I guess before you read it, you wouldn't really think about it in your day-to-day life, right? And he just gives like a fuller elaboration of mimetic desire and giving some examples of how that works. All right, another one is, I guess since I'm here, I just want to like share all the quotes that I wrote down. So let's see. "We cannot want what we lack a model for. The model that we adopt for the future is critical to the formation of our desires." Okay. Yes. So it aligns with this theory, which is that our goals are manufactured based on the models underlying ourselves, and the models provide the foundation for our mimetic desires. So in a way, we have to change in order to really orient our true interest to our desire. We have to first realign, spot where our models are, who our models are, and try to adjust it or eliminate the models from our systems altogether if they're not really good for us. And then we could adopt a new sort of foundation, etc., so that we have better goals. And then we can really go for what we really, really want, what really interests us in a good way. Yes, this all sounds very great and good. It sounds very empty now that I'm talking about it. Okay, there's another thing in the book which I wrote down, which is speaking of cultural stagnation. So I think this is quite interesting. This is just theoretically, it's something that It's probably true, but it doesn't have to do with me, really. So, it's, yeah. So, he talks about transcendent desire or transcendent goals. And let me find the quote. So, he says that, and he's talking about culture at this point, and most likely American culture, right? So, basically, he started with this person called Ross Douthat. Ross Douthat, D-O-U-T-H-A-T. So it's another guy who wrote another book about technology and how we're comfortably numb. And he applies this thought and he says, quote, this is from the author, right? He says, "We lack a transcendent reference point outside the system. Meanwhile, everyone is more or less imitating everyone else. Our culture is stuck because we're fighting over space in a pool next to the ocean. Yet nobody dares to talk openly about it, this mimesis. It's the hidden force driving our cultural development, and yet it's taboo to speak it up, to speak about, like envy." So I think it's a pretty great quote. We are fighting for space in a pool next to the ocean. So in a way, he's just saying that we should look beyond our petty little desires and just think about more transcendent values, things that really are timeless. So that's about it. That's the gist of the book. That's what I got out of the book. Maybe if you're a better reader or if you had more like entrepreneurship, maybe you'll find something more valuable from this book. The reason I got into this book was I actually heard, I listened to this podcast that he had with a host called Amit Varma. So the podcast he was on is called The Seeing and the Unseen, hosted by Amit Varma. And it's like a 4-hour long podcast. And I to this date, I haven't finished the podcast yet, but I remember listening to that podcast and I was very impressed by him. Not because of his ideas, but because of his personal journey. So this guy actually went to Italy to study philosophy. So he just talked about his personal awakening in a way, and I just find that quite interesting. So for me, it's not the ideas that really matter, it's his journey that was inspiring. So that's how I got into this book, and I decided to just take a look at the book. I do think that there is a problem with this book, which is talking about transcendent values. So the thing is just, it's kind of, I think if we actually dig into what counts as transcendent values and we try to find things that are more everlasting, that are more permanent, everyone's gonna reach the same conclusions of what they should be desiring. So they will probably all conclude in the end that some variation of love, some variation of security, some variation of peace, some variation of community, some variation of friendship is the best for them, right? And like, it doesn't take a big self-exploring journey or retreat or a silent retreat, which he mentions in the book. It doesn't take things like that to realize that yeah, it's probably best to be loved, it's probably best to have friends, it's probably best to aim for the things that are transcendent. And even like the I think everyone could have a very basic idea of what really, really should matter in life. But I think the problem is, and so when if everyone is truly enlightened and we've all reached this point, then we end up desiring the same things again. And so there are two problems with that. First of all is, all right, then how can we say that this is the truly authentic desire, right? Second of all, because a big part of mimesis or the mimetic desire theory lies in the fact that conflicts and fights arise because we're similar, not because we're different. So that's a strong point that the author has held throughout the book. He gave a lot of examples of how scapegoats are found, how mobs are formed, and basically he used a lot of examples to illustrate how we are argue with one another because we're similar, not because we're different, right? So then the question is, if we all aim for the same transcendent values, we end up, like, I think that will happen because these are transcendent values by definition. They are things that are more permanent and they're more substantial and just thick. So if we aim for the same things, don't we end up being comparing ourselves, right? There's always, like, we're going to end up in this cycle again of comparison, of mimesis, and they're just ways to demonstrate that someone has more love than another, right? There's always going to be like a system that human beings are going to come up with to gamify the whole thing. So maybe because he's American, he's really trying to say, don't be consumerist, don't just go for the pop culture, blah, blah, blah. But let's say that the whole world's like completely enlightened and we all aim for the very foundations of being a human being, right? So love, community, and security, for example. And if these are the values that everyone is enlightened enough to accept and to chase for, I don't think that it's going to be any different from the more thin desires that we have. I think once these are established to be the cornerstone of our human community, of our human establishment, then there's always going to be competition then. And I think we will make the thick desires thin by making them loud and clear, right? I'm not sure what I mean by that. I think it's just that because it, like, by the very definition of being transcendent and permanent, I think it's just once we've identified these to be the things we really want to pursue, it's difficult to hold ourselves back from being better at it, right? Being better at loving, being better at building a community, being better at, you know, being a better friend, being more generous, right? All of these values can be gamified. And then we're going to go back to the beginning where we're in this mad competition again. And then they're going to seem shallow once they're gamified. And once they are like into this mimetic cycle. Anyway, he tries to say that that's not going to be the case, but I don't know how that won't be the case. And another thing, maybe a critique of this whole idea, is just that, yes, it's all well and good to aim for the transcendent values, but it's just damn hard. You know, I think I'm fairly privileged, I think, maybe, but even I can't, like, there's, I don't know what to make of it. The basic thing I'm trying to say is that there must be a cutoff point before you can really start to, after which you can really start to think about these grand transcendent values. But before that point, it's really, really difficult and against human nature to ignore what your neighbors are having and doing, right? Again, of course, he tries to give examples of people who are beyond that point, right? People who's got everything and yet they're still trapped in this mimetic desire. I just don't think, well, first of all, I just don't think it's feasible, right? If you're living in community, it's just difficult to ignore what everyone else is doing, what you're seeing on TV, what you're seeing in movies, and it takes so much time and effort, you know? Okay, so these are not critiques, but just questions for him. Like, if we all aim for the same transcendent values, wouldn't it be gamified again? And then once it happens, wouldn't the mimesis thing cycle start again? We're just trying to compete with each other, who gets the most love, etc., right? Another thing is, like, wouldn't there be a cutoff point where, yes, you need to have a certain amount of thin desires fulfilled before you can really think about the thick stuff? Or is it possible to really have no thin desires whatsoever before you go for the thick stuff, right? I think he made an example somewhere saying that three people doing the same things can have very different motivations. So it's their motivation that really matters. maybe that's a legit point. Maybe that's, but if that's the only point that is there, it's quite a shallow point, I think, because all right, you can think about, you can change your attitude about why you're doing certain things, right? Anyway, so it's just overall, I like the theory behind it. I like the thinking that, yeah, the technological advancements aren't really advancements. Like he says in the book that iPhone 2007 is no different from the newest iPhone, which I disagree with like 20 to 30%. I mean, there are some differences, but I sort of get the gist of that, and I find that quite interesting if you think about it that way. But at the same time, there's no real practical advice, I would say. You just sort of have to have this leap in faith or sort of be enlightened somehow, and then you can see things differently, and then you can have a different attitude towards a lot of things. So that's why I'm not going to make this book into like a unique podcast episode. It's what I've been reading. The thing is, oh, and this is going to become like a long episode in the end. Thing is, like, coupled with the ultra processed people I read last week, and just a lot of things, I feel like the overall message that I'm getting is just, it's a simple message, which is to be real. I think that's the real message of the thing, right? So in Wang Ting, in this book, he has a graph that shows how thick desires are gonna be gonna lift you up steadily, whereas thin desires like, oh, I want a bigger garden, or oh, I want a different dog, or oh, I want a different car, these things are gonna fluctuate and they're gonna make you hungry still. And I just think there's like an interesting comparison to ultra processed food, as in, yeah, they're not really foods and they're just chemicals, and they're gonna make you hungrier, and you're gonna spike, like your insulin level is gonna be unstable, things like that. So it's just, there's like an interesting parallel of the two ways of thinking or two books. And I think the underlying message is like, go for the real thing. Go for the real food. Go for the real human things that interest you and your soul and your mind, right? So ultra process people is about the physical, the real physical stuff. And wanting is about like avoiding the ultra processed manufactured desire. Go for the more authentic, the real thing for your soul. So, but then ultimately they revolve around the same thing, which is about just forget about human civilization and just like be raw. I think that's the ultimate messages of these books. Maybe I just happen to pick up books like this. Anyway, so that's a big long open monologue. I think that's about it for today. I think I don't like this episode exactly. It's just a bit scattered, but I just wanted to do this, right? So I will see you in the near future. That's about it. Have a great spring. Bye.